Welcome to Pondus Computer Repair Podcast, episode number 249, Auditing Process for New Client. I'm your host, Jeff Hallish. This is our live call-in show for computer repair techs. We answer your questions on running and operating your computer repair business. Call-in number is 1-888-697-0162. Let me introduce the co-host. We have John Dubinsky from the Maven Group. How are you doing, John?
Better than I deserve. The big question is what are we doing for show 250?
Ooh, show 250. I don't know. Is that like a stellar show, or is that like midway between that and 500? I don't know.
You're the boss. I just work here.
Also joining us today, we have Chris Carruthers from Remote Support Tech Team. How you doing, Chris?
Hot.
Yes.
Hot.
You know, if you shaved that beard, you probably wouldn't have that problem.
Well, if you shaved that head. Oh, wait, never mind.
Whoa, that went from 0 to 100.
I was going to say, you know what? That's fine, because for the two Linux people to watch this show, they love you.
Oh, good.
All right. So let's go ahead and take care of a little business up front. What we want to do is we're going to change up the show just a little bit today. And to give everybody what was going on, we had some technical difficulties in the background. Those are all taken care of now to the best of our ability, and we are ready to roll. So what I wanted to do is I want to take a moment and talk about the Unconvention 2017 from the standpoint of why I wasn't there. My understanding is there was a lot of people that contacted me afterwards and said, hey, Jeff, missed you. Was, you know, looking forward to meeting you. And I realized that as I was giving out the information for the Unconvention, I never made it clear that I was not going to be there. So to give you why, the biggest reason why I wasn't there, number one is I am very busy. I have a full-time job. I go to school. I work overtime. I've got all kinds of things. I run a computer repair business in the background when I can, when I have the time. And I do these podcasts, which we have been doing every week for many years now, actually, a little over 3 years. So my time is very limited. That was number one. I am away from, you know, when I'm sitting here in my office, I'm podcasting, I'm doing all these things to help other people out. Well, my family is doing whatever it is they do, but a lot of the stuff we're not doing together. So for me to take a weekend and leave my family here to go and enjoy and being with my peers and learning and all that kind of stuff and giving the information that I have, it's just not something that I could justify. So I would have had to bring my family with me, and that incurs a lot of extra cost. So with that being said, that is the biggest reason of why I wasn't able to get there this time. And in the future, as I advertise or do things on this show, just understand that you can always email me and ask me, you know, personal questions or whatever. But a lot of things that we might advertise on this show, I am going to wholeheartedly stand behind, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I use that product or service for myself. And the same thing with conferences and conventions and different things like that, is that if I'm talking about them from a standpoint, I believe them in them, and I think other people need to go to them, then the biggest reason is what we do here on a regular basis is we try to give the information to help others. And that is what a lot of these conferences and conventions do. But the difference is you actually get to stand face to face. You get to see somebody's expression. You actually get to shake their hand. You get to talk to them one-on-one, where a lot of times you can't take the time during shows like this to talk to those people. So that's why I believe these things are important. But I just want to let everybody know why I wasn't there at the Unconvention 2017. Obviously, John was there. We had Marvin B. Paco LeBron went. So we had a lot of people that had been on this show and, you know, are on Podnuts Pro and different things. Matt Rainey from Podnuts Pro, he was there. So we had a lot of people from Podnuts that was actually there representing, just not me. So I hope that everybody understands. And like I said, in the future, feel free to ask, and I would definitely will let you know. So John, let's go ahead and take a couple extra minutes and talk about the Unconvention. Has been talked about on a couple other shows, but kind of give your 2 second spiel.
Yeah, 2 seconds is what I'll give, because I already did a show with Lori Tishney and B on Podnuts Pro where I would suggest we gave maybe our critical overview. Maybe critical is far too strong of a word, but what we thought could be improved and what we really liked, and went over all the sessions. So if anybody's interested in that, I would suggest they check that out. Again, even on that show, but I want to stress it enough. Thanks isn't a strong enough word to Matt Rodella, Corey Fruitman, or Dave Greenbaum, who I would suggest were the hub of the wheel for putting that convention on. I will definitely go to the next one, no matter what it's called. It's just great to see those guys. And, if you put a dollar figure on it, I probably sunk a grand into the weekend with hotel, airfare, food, fun, all that kind of good stuff. And I would suggest it was worth every penny. Not only what I took away from the conference, but I would suggest I got more from the things that were not directly related to the conference, meaning just some side conversations I had interacting with other techs. And then the conference was just more value. So, yeah, high five. It was great on Convention 2017. Looking forward to next year. Hope you and Chris can make it next year.
All right. Very cool. And so with that note, before we get into the tips and tricks session, let's go ahead. And I want to also let people know that Podnuts Daily is not only going to get some new guests coming on from the On Convention. There's some people that are getting signed up now as we speak. But Podnuts Daily here in the near future, like towards the end of October, is going to have a slight change. So I encourage everyone, there's only been 12 Podnuts Dailies recorded this year. So I encourage everyone to, if you've unsubscribed from that podcast, definitely resubscribe to Podnuts Daily and look forward to the new, more consistent stuff that is coming down the road. And that's all I'm going to say about that. All right. So, John, actually, let's go to Chris. Chris, why don't you go ahead and share a tip or story with us?
So big tip that I'm going to leave with you guys comes back to managing expectations. So I had a client where we were setting up a site-to-site VPN between two offices that did not have static IP addresses. So we picked up some routers that had DDNS built into it. Got everything set up, got everything configured, and then wound up finding out that even though we had the modem set up into bridge mode, the ISP was still blocking the VPN port. So it was probably a good 3 weeks of arguing with the tech support with their ISP before they finally figured out what they were doing on their end. Anyway, long story short, the workers at the offices were completely apprised of the situation. However, apparently they weren't passing the information on to the owner. So the expectations have not been properly set with the owner, and I received a very strongly worded letter about the length of time that it was taking to get everything done and wanting a full explanation as to why that was. So, yeah, make sure that you're keeping expectations set with your clients, because if you don't, that could really damage your relationship with them.
Okay, very good. John, what do you got for us?
I got a couple shout-outs really quick, and it's going to lead to my tip. These are all from the Unconvention. So Mike, who I would suggest is the key, Michael, who kills all the malware, Anton, who has the tool, Matt, it's a Jeep thing, David, there's a checklist, right? Taryn, my West Coast beer man, and Paul, the NetTool, leads me to my tip of the week, which is called NetTool at NetOol. Yes, NetOol.io is a network engineering tool. I know we've all heard B talk about the Link Sprinter and all his Fluke tools, and I talk about my POC Ethernet tool, which I like very much. Paul over at Keys Computers suggested everybody at the Unconvention take a look at the NetTool.io. And this is a great little device if you do not need anything to do cable verification. It is definitely focused at looking at network aspects like VLANs, switch ports, switch IPs, spanning tree, link aggregation, DHCP, QoS, EAP. I was waiting for you to pass out with the acronyms, Jeff.
I'm letting you go because I just, at this point, it's like, whatever.
But it's a great tool. The price is right. It's less expensive than the other tools. If you don't need the cable testing, they have a bundle. If you have a team that you want to buy some for, I tested it. I bought it from Amazon. I actually just returned it because I have my POC Ethernet and it kind of duplicated that. And I do want or need the cable testing features of that product. But if you don't need those, this is a great tool. So check it out.
All right. Very cool. All right. So my tip is basically something I was thinking about the other day, and it just popped up to me. You have this thing where if you think about human years versus dog years, and it's 7 years for a dog. A dog ages 7 years. Yeah, we're not talking about Marines. Just settle down. So 7 years for a dog compared to one human year. Well, I started thinking about this because we all have a time that we put in place on telling our customers to, you know what, that computer's old enough, you need to get rid of it. So here's what I came up with. I think, and this is my own personal opinion, is that you basically have one human year for equals 15 computer years. So 15 years. Now, if you think about it, you buy that brand new, spanking brand new laptop, and it's man, it is out of the gate. It's running just awesome. It's just kind of going. You get things settled in. You move some things around, and everything's great. After the first year, that thing's 15 years old. Well, 15 years old, you know, you're still spry. You're a young teenager. You're ready to go out there and get it. You're still running strong. You keep on going, keep on going. Year number two, you hit 30 years. Well, now at 30 years, you know, you've got a lot more wisdom behind you. Things are still solid. Things are still working good. And they might be just starting to slow down just a little bit. Well, get to year four. Now we're at 45 years. Well, let me tell you, when I hit my 40s, it was a big wake-up call. Because a lot of things tend to change. Not as young as I thought I was. Can't do the things I used to do, even though I still try. So a lot of times you end up, you know, you're starting to really slow down there, right? And the computer's kind of, you know, it's kind of going, and it still works. It's still solid. You know, maybe there's a broken hinge or something, but, you know, not a big deal. You can still open and close it. No big deal. Then you go to the 5-year mark, and that is 60. So now you've got a 60-year-old computer, and this thing is, you know, it's really starting to slow down at this point, and it's starting to have, you know, some problems that creep up now and then. Not all the time, but they come and they go. Well, you get to year number 6, now you're looking at 75 years. And you're really starting to slow down, and things just really aren't working, you know, as well. You've got to turn off and turn on a lot more than you used to when you were a lot younger. And so, as you can see, you can go on to year 7, that would be 90, and year 8 would be 105. And the reason this came up is because somebody had said, They were asking a customer about their computer. And, oh, yeah, you know, how old's your computer? Oh, it's pretty new. And this thing was bought in 2007. And this was just recently. So the thing was already 10 years old. It's like, no, your computer's way gone. You shouldn't even be using that thing anymore. You should be on it something new. So here's where I kind of go, you really need to replace your computer probably a minimum of every 4 years. Because that's when you're going to get the most out of it, in my opinion. From what I've seen, from my own equipment that I build, from laptops I've had, all this stuff. It's, you know, and phones are even worse. Phones are really about 2 to 3 years. And year three, you're really starting to see some problems a lot of times with a phone.
As crazy as I think you were when you brought this up, I think you might actually have something here. But I have a question.
Yeah.
Is it possible to do reconstructive surgery and get some new hips and all that kind of stuff? So, you know, some of our friends on other podcasts say, hey, we could add some memory or maybe toss in an SSD and breathe new life into these machines through some a new hip or maybe some medication.
It's a possibility. Here's my problem with that. Yes. Can you get time out of it? Absolutely. We'll make it an instantaneous difference. Absolutely. Here's a problem. That's as long as something else doesn't break down. And when we're talking about electronics, everybody knows electronics break down, and they're digital, basically. They're either on or they're off. They're working or they're not. You do have intermittent problems with, you know, electrical and stuff like that. But for the most part, it's either working or not working. So, yeah, could you get another year or two? Sure, you could. Or you could spend a couple hundred dollars that you're, or, you know, a few hundred dollars you're going to spend for that reconstructive surgery and just double that and go get something nice, shiny, and new. And it'll last you longer. So, I guess there's two ways of looking at it. Chris, what were you going to say?
I was just thinking about the replacement hip, but, you know, if your leg breaks too, then you're still not walking.
Oh, I wonder, how long can you actually get out of a, if you take, I guess a four-year-old computer, you could probably do some things to make them quicker.
I would say that if you've got a four-year-old laptop, you could toss an SSD in there to get another 3 years out of it. But then, you know, when you're coming up to that second, fourth year, you know, at 8 years old, I'm not doing anything with it. I'm having to replace it.
Right, right. Okay.
Oh, yeah. At some point, you got to draw a line in the sand. I agree. You know, 3 or 4 years, just a simple SSD update might get you three more.
Man, here's the thing.
I mean, what are you using it for, really?
Well, and that all depends. Listen, a lot of people don't know the crap that they have because they're used to it. When I come down, if a person comes down and turns the power button on, and yeah, it boots up in 15 seconds because it's got a brand new SSD in it, but the programs and everything that are loading up after that and kind of going along, and I still got to go get a cup of coffee and maybe make a pot, get a cup, come back, sit down. Well, I don't know. Maybe it helps to a certain extent, but if I don't know what slow is, to me, it's normal. So maybe to those customers, that is normal. But all right, let's go ahead and move out from there. And thank you for thinking I was crazy on that topic, John. but it is true, because I've always said, how do you equate electronic years to human years?
You're crazy all the time, Jeff.
It's the way we roll. All right. So this topic we're going to talk about, our main topic. Actually, let's take a quick break. And if you have not yet signed up to be a guest on PodNuts Daily, where you can talk about your business, about what you do, it is one of the only podcasts I know that you can absolutely do that all year round. I would suggest you email to guest@podnuts.com and get signed up. And we'll get you on the calendar, get you interviewed and all that kind of stuff, and see how it is that you do business. All right, going into the main topic. All right, so let's go. We're going to talk about auditing a new client. Now, I realized, actually, just before the show, we actually did a show on this similar, and it's called Onboarding a Customer. But what I want to do is I want to take a different cant on this. And when you go into a new client's office, and you're looking at their network and you're seeing what's going on, a lot of times for a lot of people, it can be very, very overwhelming. You don't know where to start. And that can be a hard thing to do. So I want to read this email that was sent to John, and then we'll kind of talk about this subject here. It says, "Hi, John, I would be interested in a show about the auditing process everyone goes through for a new client. I'm a few weeks on my first MSP client, and it has been a bit of a struggle. She's been pretty good about things, but her network was a mess. Her server is about 9 years old and completely muddled up. I wouldn't even know where to start to be able to sort it out in a timely fashion." Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. All right, I was hoping you may be able to help me with this. She is an accountant, and it is only her and her daughter there full time. They have a receptionist that comes in 2 days a week and will probably bring in another accountant during tax season. I would like to get her off this behemoth server she has onto something more to fit her situation. I bought a Synology a few months ago and have been messing around with it so that I am not sure how that would work with the centralized accounting software through it. She has moved to Office 365, and I may talk to her about online QuickBooks and such. Although the thought of not being able to work if the internet is down isn't that appealing. Cheers, Josh." Who wants to start? So what do we do when you walk into a client and you see all these different things going on? Maybe they're using hosted exchange on premise. Maybe they're using, you know, you go in your network closet and it's a mess. They're using a server that hasn't been updated in several years and looks like it's on its way out. But you've got different things you need to do. So let's talk about where does a person start when they walk into this type of mess?
So making the assumption that we've already done what we talked about in our onboarding.
Yes.
Okay. So now we have the job, we made the commitment, we're standing in the by the main distribution frame, looking at all the cables, wondering why we took this job and wondering where to start. Right?
Yeah, exactly. You're like, oh, what did I just step into?
So the first thing I would do is fire up my laptop, plug in my laptop, and run a product by SoftPerfect called Network Scanner. There's other tools like this, too, at the Unconvention. Mike at the Mike Tech Show talked about Newt, N-E-W-T, that he likes. You know, what we're talking about is a network scanner, an IP scanner. So it will perform a ping sweep of the entire LAN, discover anything on IPv4, IPv6. It'll detect all the MAC addresses of all the network-connected equipment and then try to identify the vendor for that equipment. It'll look for internal and external IP addresses. If you set it, it will look for shared folders on the network. So as it's running into a host, it will find out if there's a shared folder on that host. It'll listen for open TCP ports or UDP or SNMP. It will find users that are currently logged on. So it'll give you a generic, you know, the main thing you're going to see there is everybody's using the same username or user. Login is everybody else. And you can launch some third-party apps from there. So I could right-click on what it finds and launch the web interface of, let's say, a printer or something like that. So that's the way I start with my initial thing. And then the first thing I do before I run that is I run through the office and try to make sure every piece of equipment that I can find and physically locate and visualize is on. Because otherwise, when you run your scanner, you'll get burnt if it's not on. So that would be my first step.
Chris?
That's a fantastic first step. And that's definitely where you want to start because you need a full inventory of everything that's on the network. I'd also be asking if there's anything that isn't generally on or if there's anything that's on a separate network. So just as an example off the top of my head, I was doing some work for a yacht club. The yacht club has a security system that's on a separate network. So there's no interaction between the main network and the security network. So to properly support that, you know, if I didn't ask that question, I wouldn't have known. And I like to try to assess the knowledge level of whoever it is that I'm going to be dealing with for the most part, you know, because I want to know at what level I can speak to my contact and at what level they understand their own systems. I mean, you know, a really big example there, and I'll just pull it right out of the email that you got about, you know, they're thinking about switching to QuickBooks Online. They're an accounting firm. If their accountant thinks that they're going to be able to switch to QuickBooks Online, then their accountant doesn't understand QuickBooks and they're going to need to be educated on why that's not going to be a good idea. So, you know, you don't want to get stuck not knowing what you're doing when the user doesn't. I guess is kind of where I'm going with that.
Okay. Very good. Now, the other question would be, obviously there's many things, we talked about where to start, but there are many things that are going on here. Number one, obviously, this person is an accountant, it sounds like, and it's her and her daughter, and they have a receptionist that comes in a couple days a week. So it sounds to me like there's three people in this office, small office. Now, from that standpoint, it sounds like Josh has moved them over to Office 365, which is good. Now, the second part of this would be there's a 9-year-old server. I can't fathom any absolute idea where you would actually need a server for three people.
No, I can.
I can too. Go ahead, too? Chris, because I know where you're going.
Okay. All right. Let's just go with what we know so far. And what we know so far is that we've got at least three people in an accounting firm, sometimes four if they pull somebody in during tax season, which means that you're going to have a repository of QuickBooks files that you're going to be working on with QuickBooks Desktop. No, you can't move all of that to QuickBooks Online. It just can't happen. You need to have some sort of a central database where you're going to have all of those files, where the files can be hosted properly so that it can be accessed by all of the systems. You're also probably going to want to allow the main accountant to be able to connect into that from home so that they can do work from home, because during tax seasons, accountants don't actually sleep. So having a proper server to be able to set all of that up with will make sure that not only are you going to be able to have all of the security measures that you need to have in place to be FINRA compliant, but you're also going to make sure that everybody is going to be able to access what they're supposed to at any given time.
John?
Yeah, I would go back in this example and say just exactly what Chris said, especially if they're going to keep any sort of QuickBooks in-house. You know, if they're running Enterprise or anything like that, they need a Windows box to run that. It's not like they have to spend a lot of money on it. With that amount of people, they could use Windows Foundation or something like that, which would run that successfully. But, you know, ditto on Chris. So, exactly.
So is this something where you would not use a workstation as a server in this particular case? You would actually want a regular dedicated, I mean, you could dedicate a workstation, which a lot of people actually do still today, but you would actually say that going up to a Windows server would be the better way to go?
I would recommend a Windows class server box, you know, like a Dell PowerEdge or something. You don't have to get something that's extremely expensive. But, you know, my argument going back to that would be, well, you're running your entire business on it. You know, let's spend a couple more dollars to make it that much more reliable. To answer your question, honestly, could you run it on a workstation? Yes, although I'll wait to see what Chris says.
Could? Yes. Yes, absolutely. You could. And if there is a company that refuses to buy a server and they have a workstation and they're not an accountant... I'm gonna really hit on that in a second. Multi-user mode on one QuickBooks file. You could run that off of a workstation, a higher-end workstation, and you probably won't have very many performance issues. Where you start to run into problems is when you have three accountants working on six files in single or multi-user mode, it doesn't matter. The more QuickBooks files you have open and running off of that server at the same time, the harder it's going to hit that system. You don't need an expensive server to handle all of that, but a server is going to be able to handle the memory load a lot better than a high-end workstation will be able to with multiple connections like that. On top of that, you still have to worry about the security aspect of working from home. So yes, you could use TeamViewer to connect into a workstation at the office so that you can continue working. But a lot of these accountants just have a laptop and they bring the laptop back and forth between home and work. So having an Active Directory server, having that VPN is going to allow them to do that, whereas just having a regular workstation that they're remoting into doesn't. And the security just isn't there.
Okay. And John, what would a low-cost server cost for this particular office?
Well, if I was going to do a low-end server, I would probably look at the Dell PowerEdge T130. I would probably toss Windows Foundation on it, because that gives you up to 15 users, and you can do Active Directory with it and all that kind of stuff, or group policy and all that kind of good stuff if you want. If it is a micro office, you could also run this in just work group mode as well, and it would still give you a lot of the benefits of running a server OS. So there's some options there. Depending on how it's configured and what you have in there, meaning if you want a RAID array, if you're going to put 32 gigs of RAM in it, that sort of thing, you could probably get anything in there from $900 to $1,500.
Okay. Now, from the standpoint, because I understand a lot of these small businesses. They're like a lot of people out here. You know, I was doing this business from my house for a very long time, still am. And I remember using old machines as bench computers, and they were just old ones that I had moved down and nobody else was using. So I decided to use those as a bench computer. Hey, why to save myself a buck? Now, was that the smartest thing to do? Well, maybe not. It got me through. But a lot of these small businesses, man, it's like, especially when it comes to things like accounting, it's like a feast or famine. So you feast for a few months out of the year and the rest of the year, it's like, you know, so to count that cost and say, let's spend $1,000 to $1,500. That's a pretty hard sell sometimes.
You know what? That's actually a really good point, Jeff. And I have a word for you. Lease.
Okay.
Right. if you as the business owner can afford to, like you, the computer business owner, can afford to spend the $1,500 to get the server set up for them, plus your labor or whatever. So let's say $1,800. If you could turn around and tell them, all right, so we want to replace this every 5 years, let's say, because they're penny pitching and you don't want to push the 4 year mark. We want to replace this server in 5 years. So that means that you are going to be paying, I don't know, $150 a month. Whatever. I'm just doing math in my head right now, so don't start with me. That's going to have your service contract embedded into it. That's going to have, right, anything that you're going to embed into that lease, so that they're making a nice small sub $200 a month payment for not only the server but the support that you're going to provide with the server as well. That makes it an easier pill for them to swallow. It means that they're going to be able to write it off as an expense without adding it as equity into the company. Ask your accountant why that's a good thing. So you know, you can make it really attractive for them to do that on top of the benefits of having a properly working system with proper security and proper networking for their files. So yeah, you can make it look really good so that you don't wind up walking in and having your IT person freak out because you're running your QuickBooks server off of a 15-year-old laptop running Linux.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, he did.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. So hopefully that's now let's go into the second part of this email. And that talks about things like a Synology. Now, I don't think you can run a database from a Synology NAS, correct?
Depends on the type of database. Synology does support some of the open source databases through some plugins like MySQL and some other things, but your application would have to be able to run on a NAS to do that. And then again, sometimes I think it would just be easier just to get a server.
Yep. QuickBooks will not support... Okay, hold on. Let's say this right. QuickBooks will not officially support a solution like that. And before you ask, QuickBooks will not support running it over Dropbox. Because that usually winds up being solution number two that gets presented.
You mean Dropbox as a server?
Dropbox as a convenient file sharing application in order to allow you to share the database files. But no, that doesn't work.
You know, this brings up another good point. There are, and I'm kind of playing devil's advocate on some of this, but there are some good points as far as sometimes we need to let the customer know why it is they need to pay whatever for the IT support, the IT hardware that they need to run their business so that they can do what they're good at. And the support can be in the background where they're not worried about that. They just do what they're good at, and maybe they can get more customers to cover the expenses instead of just looking at it as an expense. Like Chris said, it is a write-off. You know, I think a lot of times people don't remember that. It's like, hey, listen, if you take home all the money that you make during the year, all your gross receipts, then you're going to pay Uncle Sam a pretty penny. So what you want to do to offset that a little bit is you want to kind of spend some of this money. And you need to do it in a way that makes sense for your business so that you can get the most tax benefit out of it you can. And I'm surprised, but I know this happens all the time. Accountants of all people should know this. But again, anybody that has a small shop or small business, this is how a lot of people think, unfortunately. So it's our job to go in there and tell them why and for what reason they need our services and the hardware we recommend. All right, let's see. So as far as now, we didn't even talk about compliance and things like that. We've talked about, we go in, everything's a mess. Now, Chris, you talked about actually going in and getting into the server remotely from home. Now, should you have a proper business router / firewall / whatever to protect that office and to be able to do things like VPN and stuff like that?
Yes. And since you have a proper server with Active Directory, you can configure VPN services through the server so that you're logging into the network through a secured VPN.
Okay. John?
I'm not a huge fan of the VPN services in Windows, so I always use the VPN services that are in my router, but I would suggest that is six of one or half dozen of another.
Well, let me ask this, and maybe nobody here knows, but from a compliance standpoint, we're talking about things like finance in this particular case. Can you have a Linksys home router that's sitting there on the network doing whatever it does and still be compliant from that standpoint? Or should you have a business class router in this type of business?
I'll let Chris go for Canada first. Go ahead. I'm sure it's a little different.
Yeah, well, it's Pipita here. It's the same idea. Should you have that router in there? No, you should. You should not have that router. Will it cause you to fail an audit? It depends. Where is it? What's it doing? What's it being used for? Is that the first router that's attached to your gateway and therefore the main firewall for your network? Then yeah, you're going to wind up running into some issues. Did somebody bring it in and plug it into an Ethernet jack in one of the offices to basically act like a switch? Well, then, you know, that's probably not going to make anything fail. But they really should have talked to me first because I could have put a proper switch in.
Okay. John?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where you pay me now or you pay me later. So for FINRA, which is what the financial stuff here in the United States is right now, basically, and you can, people can correct me if I'm wrong. Right now, FINRA is pretty much encrypt everything. So meaning the desktop server, everything is encrypted on one end. It doesn't have the same compliance regulations as like HIPAA does at this point, at least from a small business endpoint, meaning if I'm a financial person or an accountant. But with that said, if you would have been at the unconvention, David Sims spoke to this too. The whole, let's just say the FINRA guys are taking a hard look at what the HIPAA guys are doing. And I think that would probably come as well. The guidance I would give that you should break down and give to your customers is to look at the NIST, NIST documentation and what those requirements are for cybersecurity. And yes, in that case, you do need a UTM device.
And here's the thing. A lot of people are not realizing this, but we're talking about things that have been enacted a long, long time ago.
90s.
And yeah, and now it's coming to the point where they're actually starting to crack down. And in my opinion, it's only going to move forward in that direction. So the things you can do for your customer now, and again, maybe it's not something you need exactly today, but maybe it's something that you need to build into when you're talking to your customer over the next year. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to take some time. And we're going to, in, you know, month three, we're going to put this in. In month six, we're going to put this in. In month nine, we're going to put this in. And here's the things we're going to do over the year. And then here's what a lot of people don't do. And I've said this before. Other people have said this. You really need to get your customers to build in an IT budget. Everything else that they pay for and they do is budgeted in for the most part, except when it comes to IT. Because for whatever reason, people think it's willy-nilly and only is needed at a certain time when something breaks normally. And that's usually when they go into panic mode. But they can avoid that panic mode by having some sort of cash flow that's put off to the side to be able to pay for this stuff or even have managed services that we all provide to help them throughout the whole year instead of just a little bit at a time.
So looking at all this from a managed services perspective, you know, the next questions I would ask is we've talked about a little bit about servers, and I'm going to tie this back into this question about this router, Jeff, is I would also be asking, where is the demarcation point in the building? Where do all the services come in? I would be looking at routers, switches, NAS devices, access points, whatever's there now, printer, scanners, copiers. I'd also be asking about the phone system, the fire system, the security system, and if they have any elevators in the building that they have to manage, because that will tie into a lot of areas into what needs to be there as far as phone connectivity. Big question I put on my list last year is this the only office? Because I found out a client had a different office about 6 months into work. So that was an interesting one. But also define who your contact person is, their ISP information, the domain. All this will be in the show notes. Anything they need, you need to do with their domain name, where the registrar is, and how to get access to that. Tie that into their email and where all that is hosted. Passwords you need to know and documents. I think we're talking about line of business applications, whether that be QuickBooks in this case or something else that they might be using. Hardware, software, VPNs. And that is the end of my list. But to go back, now that you have your inventory and you've asked all these questions, my first question would be is, what router do they have now? And let's say they do have that Linksys router. What's the model number on it? Then my next question is to do a little bit of research to say, was that device already on a compromised list of something that we know has been compromised? And there is no new firmware update. You know, if you go to the Linksys page and the newest firmware is 6 years ago, you know, that might be something where I would approach a customer and said, look, this is a priority item. This hasn't been updated in 6 years. Can, you know, how much has just your technology in your office changed in 6 years? And also look that this is also has known vulnerabilities, which means you probably already have been poked and prodded to be compromised. So this is our priority item, along with those wireless, you know, and anything else. I mean, if you listen to Security Now, every week there's some manufacturer that's in the doghouse because, what was it, D-Link this time? I think they found 10 vulnerabilities in some D-Link routers that give people complete access through the router and to the router. So, you know, that's, you know, some people say, don't scare your clients. I say, well, you know, why even lock the doors? Just leave the doors open when you leave on the way out too, if we're going to use that equipment at the same time.
Good point.
I don't think it's scaring your customer to tell them that, look, you know, we know that there's a known problem with this router where if you go to a specific URL, you know, toss something in after the slash, it'll take you into the administrative portal for your router without a password. You know, that's the type of thing that they need to know so that they know that it either needs to be patched or needs to be replaced. It isn't scaring them. It's informing them of what's happened. And if they choose not to take action on it, then that's, you know, par for the course, I guess, for some of these companies.
Well, it's funny when you're talking about, you know, residential off the box or, you know, big box store routers or whatever, the home routers, these things might have one firmware update in the whole shelf life of that particular router. That's usually all you're getting. You're not getting year by year. It doesn't work like that. So, yeah, there's a lot to be said for that stuff. So, all right. Well, is there anything else we can touch on this? I think we've kind of looked at just kind of some of the areas that you want to look at, some of the things that I wanted to address in this particular email, just to let people know what types of things you need to look for and how you need to steer your customer in the direction that they need to go. And again, you're the expert. They're not. So hopefully this information has helped you. All right. Let's take another quick break and we'll move into our next section. All right. If you guys want to support this show and what we're doing over here, go to patreon.com/computer repair podcast. And I want to thank all of our Patreon supporters for your continued support. I appreciate each and every one of you. All right, let's answer some emails and take some phone calls. Phone lines are open. The call-in number is 1-888-697-0162. And our first email, this is from Ed Marshall. Says, hi, guys. One more thing I thought of. Ed had an email last week, so this is part two. For my back-end stuff, I'm reviewing Repair Shopper and QuickBooks. Are any of you doing something similar and have feedback on how they may have worked for you?
Okay. So Repair Shopper uses the QuickBooks web integration tool, which means that, if that's what it's called, shoot. I don't know. There's an integration tool that they have for QuickBooks Desktop, and it's basically an app that you run on your desktop and it imports the transactions from Repair Shopper into QuickBooks Desktop. Now, I haven't used it in a number of years, but when I was using it, it was working quite well.
Okay. And I think they also have support for QuickBooks Online also, correct?
Yes, that's it's a completely different connector. That runs just through the QuickBooks APIs. So that goes from the Repair Shopper server to the QuickBooks Online. You don't have to have anything running for that. Whereas with the integration with QuickBooks Desktop, you have to have the integration tool running on your server computer or on your desktop computer to make that work.
Okay. And as far as I'm concerned, everybody knows that, I use Repair Shopper. Love it. It is a great tool for keeping track of my customers and being able to do ticketing, invoicing, all that stuff on the fly. As far as my accounting, I still use a spreadsheet.
I hate it when you say that.
And it's okay. You can still use a spreadsheet. It's okay, Chris. It's okay. No. It works.
No, it's not, Jeff. No, it really isn't.
If I tried to load a spreadsheet right now with every transaction that's happened since February 1st when my fiscal year started, I'm pretty sure Excel wouldn't finish loading.
Well, that's the nice thing about having a part-time business. I don't have to worry about those things.
Yeah, fair enough.
John, what do you say about Repair Shopper, QuickBooks? I know you were checking some things out here lately.
I've been testing out Repair Shopper, and I really like it, especially for ticketing and some other things. So I might jump on that bandwagon full time. Right now, for accounting, I use QuickBooks Online.
Okay. And you like Now, you've had QuickBooks Desktop before, though, right, John?
Maybe back in 1986, but yes.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Million years ago. So you like the QuickBooks Online? Works fine?
It's not without its issues, but yeah, I like it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to say for the record, because I know I was coming down pretty hard on QuickBooks Online a minute ago. QuickBooks Online is great if you're a business owner and you need something easy to use that you can access from anywhere. But your accountant's going to hate it, whether they tell you that or not. There's a lot of reports that you can't do yet. There's a lot of things that just don't work the same way as it does in desktop, so it's not as robust.
Okay. Fair enough. Now, I know as far as my accountant goes, I get a workbook every year that I have to fill out a few of the blanks from year to year, and all my stuff is already calculated in my spreadsheet, Chris. And so I can take those numbers, and all I do is transpose them onto the paper and then send it back. It takes me... If it takes me a half hour to do the whole workbook for personal and business finances, that's taking a long time. So
I'm super happy for you, Jeff.
If I had a 2 cents to add to the conversation, I would suggest if you're a full-time business owner, you should have a really good relationship with your accountant, because they're going to give you a ton of information about how to be successful in your business. So there should be a nice collaboration on what you use for accounting with what they want you to use for accounting.
Yes. And it is going to be personal preference too, because every accountant is going to have their personal preference of how they want to receive the information. I don't think everybody uses QuickBooks, but I think it's probably the number one go-to tool out there for accounting.
It is. And above and beyond that, you need to be able to pull the reports that you need to out of it. A lot of the online accounting systems will allow you to pull those reports so that you can figure out kind of where you stand, where your money's going. But if you can't figure out your cash flow yourself, then your accountant or bookkeeper and that accounting system is the only way that you're going to get a clear picture from them, because that's where they can pull their reports. That's where they're going to be able to tell you what's happening with your business as far as the money is concerned.
He says, I also considered FreshBooks, but I don't think it gives me the in-depth info that I could use for tax time, keeping track, etc. Has anybody used FreshBooks in the past for their accounting?
Yes.
Does it work?
I use it now. Mm-hmm.
It works?
Yeah. This is going to sound convoluted. So I have a FreshBooks account for Crothers Computers. I have a FreshBooks account for Remote Support Tech Team. And then I have a QuickBooks file for the corporation. FreshBooks is used for the day-to-day invoicing. I could track my expenses in there, but I don't. I put all the expenses right into QuickBooks. And then at the end of every week, we export everything out of FreshBooks and put it into QuickBooks for that reporting. But FreshBooks itself does have a lot of reportings available for it. And on top of that, in Canada, QuickBooks Desktop does not have the same type of online payment options like QuickBooks Desktop does in the States. So I had to get creative.
So
keeping in mind that FreshBooks is a Canadian company.
Yes.
So I just have to laugh now because every time you shake your head at me for using a spreadsheet and then you want to double enter stuff, please.
I'm not double entering anything. Yeah, QuickBooks Desktop has a function for batch importing of transactions. I just copy and paste the... oh my God, I can't believe this is about to come out of my mouth. I copy and paste the spreadsheet that's created from the CSV file that comes out of FreshBooks.
Uh-huh. Now which one of us is wrong?
There's no... nobody's... no. Okay, well, you know what? You can't send your spreadsheet to somebody with a payment link on it, so I went...
Okay, I don't need that option though, but okay.
Oh, well, whatever.
All right, moving on. All right, it says, also, are you using D7.2 and a repair shopper integration? I think that would be neat. It says, okay, no more questions for me for now. Thanks again, Ed Marshall. And the name of his business, I love this, The Marshall's Office. That's awesome.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah. So, as far as D7.2, I have not used the integration between the two. I kind of use the tool separately from Repair Shopper for whatever reason. Because I just haven't found a need for it. So I don't know. Do they have is the integration for D7 or D7 or D7.2, right?
It's D7.2 only.
D7.2 only now. Okay.
Right. They also, I'm pretty sure they also have a Repair Shopper integration for Tekwaru.
Yes. Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do Kabuto as well.
So, yeah, and that is the one nice thing about Repair Shopper, I think, is that there are a lot of people or a lot of other businesses that are integrated into that. So if you're using several different things. Now, I integrated Ninja RMM, which is the, you know, my RMM tool of choice. And so that integrates nice. So when I'm setting up a customer, it actually makes it really easy because I've got a drop down menu if they're a managed service client or if they're just a regular one-off customer, it'll give me a drop down menu of where I want to put them in that database so I can keep everybody where they need to be. So that makes it nice.
There's something really cool about Ninja and Repair Shopper too. If you use it, well, there's two pretty cool things that I learned at the UN convention. If you do use Ninja RMM and you add an asset, meaning you add an endpoint to Ninja RMM through Repair Shopper, it will automatically add that count to your invoicing, which is pretty cool, I thought. So you don't have to remember to do it.
Ooh.
If you bill per endpoint. The other thing they have is Ninja is really pushing Cloudberry Labs backup now. And there is integration through Repair Shopper for that for billing as well. So kind of nice. You're getting an all-in-one ticketing /CRM/RMM platform, which I would suggest is probably a lot easier to use than the Autotask I'm using right now.
Okay. That's good.
So thoughts, just 2 cents.
All right. So let's see. I think we have Taz is on the line. So let's go ahead and take a quick phone call here. Hey, Taz, how you doing?
Not too bad.
So do you have something to add to the conversation?
Yep. Touching on the IT budget, what do you guys use when, say, they come up to you and say, hey, I don't have an IT budget. Do you have any? And they come to you and ask what your recommendation is. Do you have a guideline, a formula that you use to come up with a budget?
That's a good question. That's a real good question. It's something I hadn't thought about. John, do you have a guideline at all that you use?
I'm working on it right now. Go ahead. Move on. Come on, I can only Google so fast.
Okay,
throw it out there.
Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it depends a lot.
No, you're not allowed to say that.
But it does. It depends a lot on the infrastructure. But generally. If you figure 30% of the current purchase cost of what it would cost to replace everything that's in that client's IT infrastructure, that is approximately what they should be budgeting for support for the year, I believe.
Sounds good.
And I would also add on top of this that the IT budget is important, but before you jump on the budget, you need to come up with a technology plan as well. Talk a little bit about business, because your IT plan has to fit with what the business objectives are as far as growth, shrinkage, acquisition, all that kind of good stuff too.
Oh, for sure. I mean, if they're planning on adding or removing employees, then you're going to have to make sure that there's adjustments in your budget to make up for that.
Thinking about it, I just think off the top of my head, like these guys are saying, I would take all the equipment that needs to be replaced and obviously set a plan forth for this year, but then understand that in X amount of years, all this stuff needs to be replaced again. So what do we need to have per year to get to year four to replace all this equipment? What can we put aside? And on top of that, the managed services you're providing them, what's the monthly cost for that? So you can get them, hey, we need to put whatever it is away. Once you do all these calculations, I don't know, a couple $100 a month away, and this will be able to replace all the equipment that we talked about that needs to be replaced in this office. Now, obviously, if the business grows, that's going to change slightly.
Just tossing it out there to push this again, you know, if everything was leased, that makes it really easy to figure out the budget.
That's definitely the leasing idea that I like.
I do, but I don't at the same time. I don't, because I don't want the responsibility of somebody else's equipment.
I'm not going to say their name on the air because I don't know if I'm allowed to. So next week, if I'm allowed to say their name, I will. But there is a leasing company that I am partnered with. So if there is equipment that needs to be bought that I cannot put out the money on or don't want to put out the money on based on the client, I can have that company send them an application so that they can do the leasing through them. So what winds up happening is I go out and I buy everything, you know, on my 30-day net credit with my distributor, go get everything installed, do all of the service, let the leasing company know that everything's done, and then the leasing company sends me a check for everything, taxes and all. And then they will charge the monthly lease to the customer for the amount plus interest.
Okay. I like that idea. So, Taz, you like the leasing idea?
Yes. That's a great option, I think.
If you do use a leasing company, though, keep in mind that you will lose the additional income from interest. That might not be a big deal for you, but for some people that do have the disposable income, that does have an account set up with Equifax or TransUnion or whatever that third one is that you guys have down there, so that you can do the credit checks yourself. You will make more money doing it, but there will be a higher risk because you're the one making sure that those payments are done.
And that's the part of the responsibility I don't want.
Yeah. So somebody like you would definitely want to partner with a leasing company rather than doing it themselves.
Yeah, because I'd rather stick a fork in my eye than do that. anyways. Well, Taz, does that answer that question?
That does. Thank you very much for your answer.
No problem. Do you have anything else?
Nope, just that the convention was phenomenal. I'm just amazed at how much I got out of it.
Awesome.
And hope to see every more people next year.
Okay. Sounds like a plan. We need to prepare for that now.
Definitely.
All right, thanks, Taz.
Thank you.
All right, so let's go ahead and we got a couple more emails we'll handle here. That was a great phone call there. This is in reference to show 247. It says, I love the show as it is. Honestly, I love just listening to you guys banter about computers and tech. It says, giveaways are not needed. You guys give enough as it is. If you could change anything, it would be to make more shows, LOL, but I can live with once a week. You guys do great. I love the show. That is from Richard Irving. That's Rich's Computer Repair. So this was a call to action we had set forth a few weeks ago, having people send us some feedback on what they liked about the show, what they didn't like about the show, different things that kind of their thought process about what we should offer as far as having call-ins Should we have that opportunity for people to be able to call in? Anything that we're doing, we're here to help. We're here to answer questions and do the best that we can so that you guys get the most out of the show. That's why we do it.
So if Richard wants more shows, I'm sure we'll hear from him on Podnuts Daily shortly.
That's a good idea. Podnuts Daily. Guest at podnuts.com, and we'll get you set up.
Thanks, Richard. We appreciate you volunteering.
Oh, what bantering, though? I mean, we're...
You know, usually when I'm telling you that you have a convoluted way of doing things and you say, yeah, you're still using a spreadsheet, no, that stuff.
I like it when you guys fight. It's very entertaining.
Is it?
And John's in the background going, fight, just... fight, 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 fight. Oh, man. All right, let's go ahead. And we've got another email, and this is from Roberto Martinez. Hello, I have been listening to your podcast. It is awesome and very informative. My question is, I have recently opened my computer repair business, and I want to install Windows into computers who need upgrades or whose hard drives have been formatted. Do you have a link on who I can contact to buy multiple Windows licenses? I've been looking online, and I'm able to find any information. Thank you, Roberto.
What? Say that again? I'm sorry. It cut out.
He's looking for a way to be able to buy packs of Windows licenses?
Yes. So one of the things that I said is, number one, what I do for my size business is I buy one-offs. I go to Amazon, Newegg, whatever. I pay the $100 OEM fee for, you know, a new computer build or whatever. Now, as far as there are cheaper ways to get Windows licenses, but it's one of those things where I feel like John said earlier, pay me now, pay me later. You sometimes can get bit by those in the future. So you have to be cautious when you're finding distributors for that type of stuff.
There are options though for smaller companies like yours, Jeff, that isn't, you know, Newegg or Amazon, where you can get a bit of a better deal without needing to buy huge bulk. Multivisions comes to mind. There is a company called Multivisions. I'll send Jeff the info, or John, unless one of you already have it. But you know, you can buy Windows 10 COAs from them, and you know, different like MCSoft licenses, stuff like that. So there are options out there. You don't have to go with TechData or one of those big distributors and get stuck into minimums when it comes to huge orders like that. When you know you can buy two or three licenses at a time from a place like Multivisions.
John?
Well, the old standard is if they're all for the same client, you can do volume licensing from Microsoft. Usually that's a minimum of 5. I don't think that's changed. But that's not the easiest thing in the world to do, and depends on who you're buying them from, because you got to go to the servicing center and then maybe get them from a distributor. I'm not sure who Chris is recommending does this or not. But there's Open Value Select, Enterprise. I mean, it's just a mess. It's not like it's easy to figure out. So, but if you do have customers that need that sort of thing, it's probably something to look into. So volume licensing.
Yeah, a couple different options there. Yeah, just like I said, I've just gone old school just because I know I'm getting a disc and usually a COA sticker, and they're given to me before I'm using them, and that's just the way I roll. That way I can give that over to the customer and say, here. Just your mileage may vary depending on who you use.
And as a micro or small business, what I might recommend is, Jeff, your idea is pretty good, but what I would suggest is sign up as an Amazon associate. I mean, you're not going to make a lot of money for this, but then send your customer the links and have them buy them direct from Amazon, and you'll get a couple points. It's not a lot, but then they can manage the keys. It's something you can kind of wash your hands of and still make a little bit of money.
There you go.
I think that would be okay as long as you're willing to deal with the fact that eventually you're going to have to tell somebody that they have to call Amazon for, you know, return support or anything like that. And if you deal with business clients, it's the same problem. They're going to want one point of contact. So you're going to have to really set that expectation ahead of time that, you know, you're providing the link, but they're buying it from Amazon. So if we need to do any returns or anything like that, it is Amazon that has to deal with it, and you're not able to assist.
And normally I would agree with you 100%, but it's, you know, I think selling a software license is pretty easy. And then Amazon returns, if you're going to return anything, it's pretty much the easiest return there is.
Oh, yeah. No. Amazon is really easy to work with. All I'm saying is you want to set that expectation with the client so that they're not expecting you to take care of it for them.
And the realization, too, is, and I like what you said, John, because if you think about it, if I'm getting the disc, I don't really care about the disc. I've got the software. That's never the issue. Okay. The issue is having the COA, certificate of authenticity, that I can slap on that sucker, you know, being a desktop or whatever, to make sure that it's on there. Once that's on there, once that license is activated, really, even at that point, when it comes to the COA, Amazon's not responsible anyway. If you need that fixed or the COA is not authenticating, then you need to go to Microsoft anyways and deal with them. So it's still going to fall under our purview, I think, in most cases when it comes to software like that. All right. This is not an email, but it is an email. So this is an email that was sent to me. And for all the business owners and vendors and people out there that try to solicit us all the time, here's what not to do. This is my own special section. All right. Let's see. And I'm not going to be such a jerk that I'm going to mention the name of the business or the person that did this, because I understand what they're doing, and that's fine. I don't have a problem with it per se, sending me one email. If I'm not interested, I'll let you know, and then kind of leave it alone. This is what happened. This says, "Hi, Jeff. My name is Jeff. And I have a client I'm working with that wanted me to see about arranging an introductory meeting with TechNut. They wanted to introduce to you the three solutions that they provide to their partners utilizing their encrypted fax over IP network. Because the network is specifically groomed to transmit fax packets, they get a 98% completion rate." Really? 98%? Okay. Whether that's good or bad or different or compared to a regular fax machine that I know sending real faxes didn't always complete 100% of the time, but whatever. All right. And more importantly, they own a patent on the AES 256 encryption standard, making them HIPAA and SOX compliant. Really? They have a patent on AES 256 encryption.
Really?
That's wow. That's a bunch of baloney, number one. So that just irritated me. It's like, if you're going to talk to me and you want me to contact you and use your business, don't sit there and lie to me in your email. Okay. Anyways, moving on. It says, which serves the industries doing the heaviest faxing volumes, healthcare, government, legal, financial. Could we schedule some time with you this week next to briefly discuss what they had in mind and how you and your customers might benefit from this solution? Let me know what day might work best or if you're not interested. Thanks, Jeff. So I'm pretty sure I'm not a jerk all the time. I'm pretty sure I sent him a response. Said, hey, I appreciate that. Not really interested in it this time. Anyways, whether I did or not doesn't matter. This is the second email I got. Hi, Jeff. I've heard it all before. Fax is dying. There are no profits or revenue in fax. All fax does is give me support issues. I hear that and have said that to myself in the past. But I know differently now. And my client and I would like to try to change your mind. Here are a few thoughts we had on their fax over IP solutions, which positively impact your revenue. Well, how do you know that? How do you know it's going to positively impact my revenue? Anyways. Penetrate verticals. Oh, there you go. As soon as you use a stupid industry term like verticals, I just fly off the handle. I'm done. Verticals, really? What does that mean to the normal, regular person? Absolutely nothing. What, am I vertically going up? Am I vertically going down? Stop using stupid industry terms. Okay, yes, I said that out loud. Okay, let's see. This fax over IP solution is HIPAA and SOX compliant. Blah, 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 blah. Eliminate support issues from your fax customers. 98% completion rate equals more, happy emoji, less, mad emoji. Really? Really? Come on. You're going to have, is this a professional or is this like Cartoon Network? What are we doing here? We're not putting emojis in the email. Okay. Don't do that. It's just stupid. offer a legally patented solution that will complete the business communication and continually solutions offered for your customers. Let's talk some more. Are Tuesdays or Wednesdays better for you to talk? Thanks, Jeff. All right. So, yeah, if you don't want to hear from me again, please let me know. It's like, there's a couple things that if you're trying to get your information across to a client, you don't want to sit here and do a bunch of smoke and mirrors and do what everybody else does. I'm going to dazzle you with baloney, family-friendly show, because you probably don't know what I'm talking about, and it sounds really good. Well, actually, that's not true. I'm an above-average intelligent person that can actually parse the information and most of that stuff. Quiet, Marine.
It's okay, Jeff. Let him finish.
And, you know, I can parse the information, get what I need out of it. Don't sit there and try to put a bunch of fluff in there that I don't really need or want. That is one way that I will never, ever call you. All right. That was the end of my rant. Any thoughts on that? As far as emails that you guys get, anything that irritates you?
I would suggest maybe over the last 6 to 8 months, that's been a trend that I've been getting those kind of marketing emails. Hi, friend.
Yeah. Using my name, which is fine. I think that's good. You did a little research. And there was something else in there. I can't remember. They said they had researched my business, which I think that was like in the second or third email. Really? You researched my business? Well, obviously, how much did you research my business to see if I'm even offering facts to any of my customers? Oh, you didn't. You found my website.
That's the whole point, Jeff. You're not offering facts, and therefore they're going to be able to help you just like this vacuum cleaner can. It can stand vertically, so it works for your verticals. The phone calls from these guys are not any better either. I've seen a huge increase in the number of telemarketing phone calls, but down to the point where they're not even trying anymore. My company is Carruthers Computers, and the last time I took a phone call a couple days ago from a telemarketer, and they said, "Hello, Mr. Computers, my name is," so they're not, there's a lot of scripts, there's a lot of copy and paste, there's a lot of trying to make you feel special by throwing all these words and all this jargon at you. But at the end of the day, it comes down to, they're trying to sell you something so that you can try to resell it to your customers. And if you can make that successful, hey, great. You can make a bunch of money out of it. But why are we going to trust a company that uses copy and paste scripts in their sales pitch? What happens when I need support? Are they going to just copy and paste some stuff out of their support book?
Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot better. I'm not sure. I understand that we're all inundated with marketing of all sorts. And most of it we probably ignore. Because again, if any of us are going to look for a solution to something, we're usually going out and getting it. And we're going to make contacts wherever we need to make contacts. Somebody coming in and putting something in my email inbox is not going to get me to call them, especially if I don't need that service at that time. Now, a lot of people will say, well, but maybe you'll think about that person down the road. Yeah, I would have if they didn't sound so stupid in their email. Now, I don't even know who that person is. They're dead to me. Gone. Done. All right. That was my rant. I'm sorry. I had to get it off my shoulders because those things irritate me.
Do you feel better though?
Yeah. Well, and I'm just hoping that us as business owners don't do that to our clients. Don't blow a bunch of stuff at your clients that they don't understand. Talk to them say, here's how I can help you. And here's what we can do. Here's your options. Option A, option B, option C. What is it you want to do? And most people, they like that. They're like, okay, I think right now I'll do option B. That's good. Okay, fine. We'll do that. All right. I think we're going to go ahead and end the show off. John, can you give us a parting tip? Maybe something positive?
Well, I think we're all probably tired of hearing about the, Experian breaches and all that kind of stuff over at Equifax. But keep in mind that Instagram and Time Warner also got hacked with millions of accounts during the exact same time. So you're not hearing about that. But if you have Users that use a lot of Instagram or users that are Time Warner customers, you better put them on the alert as well.
Okay. Where can people find you at?
Mavengroup.net or at Unconvention 2018.
There you go. Good to have you, man. All right. And Mr. Chris Carruthers, give us one parting thought and let people know where they can find you at.
Yeah, a password just isn't a password without the tangy zip of being unique. Make sure you're using different passwords with everything. Hey, come on, it's a mayonnaise
thing. It's good. I like it.
I liked that.
I like it.
Whatever.
Took me a minute to parse, but yeah, okay.
Make sure, fine. Well, you know, I don't want to strain your above intelligence IQ. Now that that's over, if you want to get a hold of us, you can reach Remote Support Tech Team at info@rstechteam.com or 866-568-2813. We are here to provide tech support for your customers.
Awesome. Appreciate you coming back out, Chris. All right. Come join us live for the Computer Repair Podcast every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern over at podnuts.com/Computer Repair Podcast Live. Join in on the conversation by calling in live and hanging out in the chat room. You can also send an email to podnuts@podnuts.com or leave a voicemail at 1-888-697-0162. We have audio available over at podnuts.com or subscribe using your favorite podcatcher. You can be notified when the show is live by subscribing to our YouTube channel, Computer Repair Podcast. I want to thank everyone for listening and subscribing to the show. We'll see you next time on Podnuts, the Computer Repair Podcast.
Music provided by Steve Cherubino at stevecherubino.com.